Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Alistair Dove, senior scientist and whale shark guru at the George Aquarium, about all things aquatic and aquarium related. Once again, if you've got a question or comment about the George Aquarium or the research going on at aquariums in general, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So you have a collaboration with Julia Kobanek and the folks at Georgia Tech.
I do, actually. We have several collaborations with Georgia Tech, and it's great that we're getting to a point where we can start taking advantage of the expertise that's over here. And so we actually have multiple research collaborations with Tech, but one of the ones that's most developed at this point is a study that we have about metabolomics in whale sharks. And so that's something that wasn't possible before we had the collection
at
the aquarium.
What is metabolomics?
What is metabolomics? Metabolomics is, there's all these fields in science these days. It's very trendy to put the word omics at the end of everything, but metabolomics is the measurement of all the small compounds in the blood, like sugars and amino acids and hormones, everything that's really not a protein, everything in the non-peptide sort of class.
And if you were working on the proteins, it would be proteomics.
That's right.
So all these metabolism-related compounds.
Right. So what you're really doing is looking at all of those at once. And there are some great techniques that have been developed over here at Georgia Tech. There's some people using NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, and that includes people like Les Gelbaum and Hanno Leeson. And then there's people who do it by mass spectrometry, like Facundo Fernandez and Mark Staszynski. And when we have collaborations with all of those folks looking at metabolism in the animals in our care. And so we can take samples that we get from the veterinary care of the animals, blood samples, and we can bring them over here to Tech. And those clever folks with those great techniques can tell us what the small compounds are in the blood, and that gives us a snapshot of the whole animal's biochemistry at once.
Well, so just a cheap plugs for the chemistry and physics nerds over here. Mm-hmm. We've actually done a couple shows on NMR. Mm-hmm. NMR is one of the things that's probably garnered 4 Nobel Prizes in its various applications. And I think we've had Haskell Beckham, who works with Les Gelbaum, talk mm-hmm. about everything from application to chemical analysis like this mm-hmm. to how water
polymers,
gets wicked
right.
in your running shirt and things mm-hmm. like that. But here it is, these geeky things like mass spectrometry and NMR being used to tell you how fish and whale sharks metabolize things.
Exactly right. And we're able, actually, those two techniques, NMR and mass spec, are really complementary. The NMR gives you some structural information about the compounds, and the mass spec gives us lists of putative compound names that we can kind of mine those lists looking for chemicals that might be good biomarkers of health for the animals in our care. And then we can take that information back to the aquarium, improve the veterinary care, and we can also take that information to the field and start asking questions about what is the health status of wild populations of whale sharks, and that wasn't really possible before we started this collaboration with Tech. So it's really great to be able to connect the clever folks with the great techniques to this really amazing collection that we're lucky to have over at the aquarium, and to be witness to this sort of science writ large. It's kind of a really unique situation because we have this thing going with whale sharks where we are learning really fundamental aspects of their biology, like how many are there, how big do they get, and how do they reproduce, at exactly the same time as we're doing really cutting edge stuff with metabolomics and genomics and other things. So it's sort of a 0-60 or 0-60 situation in 5 years, since we only opened on Thanksgiving 2005. So yeah. It's been quite an accelerated development of our science program, hopefully to the benefit of whale sharks.
And what you're saying is ultimately what this may produce is the basic chem panels that they do when you go in the emergency room, right? But you'll do it for fish and whale sharks to say, look, if potassium is up or this is down, this may mean they're missing this nutrient or something like that, or this could be very serious, we need to do something immediately.
That's exactly right. So you're looking for better clinical chemistry tools, and also that informs just fundamental biology. How does the physiology of this animal work? It's very, very different from mammalian physiology. I'll give you one example. Probably the best biomarker that we've discovered so far is a vitamin B analog called homarine, and that's never been recorded in a fish before. So what it's doing in whale sharks, we don't know, but it varies in meaningful ways, and we find that compound a very, very useful indicator. It really jumps out of the analysis.
Right.
And so, you're really discovering new things all the time. That's one of the cool things. It makes you feel like you're back in that Victorian era where
right.
everything was new.
Fundamentally new stuff. I think we've got a caller on the line. Welcome to the program. Did you have a question or comment?
I have a question. Do aquariums have legal agreements with the countries that they get the fish from? And also, do they pay money for the right to bring fish into the United
Oh, that's a good question.
It's a good question. So we get fish from lots of sources, and whenever possible, we like to get fish from our internal sources. So we like to breed them ourselves. And then you would look to the other members of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is our umbrella organization that manages all aquariums in the country. And we would look to sharing collections between those. And in fact, lots of species are managed not at the individual aquarium level, but at the AZA level. So the AZA manages who has what and where
they go. Which is the American Zoological Society.
It's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Okay.
But on those situations where we do have to go to the field to collect populations from wild populations, there's nearly always an impact study. So you want to make sure that when you take that animal out to be an ambassador for its species in an aquarium, that you're not going to have a significant impact on that population. And you always do it with the permission of the relevant authority. So you're always going to have a permit for those sorts of things. It's not done. It's no Wild West sort of situation. These things are very, very tightly controlled, and we always have to follow those sorts of regulations, and we're pleased to. And in fact, we'll usually set a higher standard than whatever statutory requirement is put on us, because we want to be doing this right. We want to be doing it safely, and we want these animals to come into our collection and be able to represent for their species, as whale sharks have. I mean, we've had over 13 million people come through the aquarium, and the vast majority of those people are never going to see a whale shark in its natural setting. So we have that opportunity while they're at the aquarium to both wow them and to use that moment as a chance to give them some educational or environmental messaging that may cause a change in behavior. They'll go away saying, wow, I really didn't know that about whale sharks, and maybe I'm going to go and seek out one of these ecotourism opportunities, or maybe I'm going to think twice before I order shark fin soup when I'm out at a restaurant. Those sorts of things, really, we're looking to change people's attitudes to the ocean and to the animals that live there.
Well, great question.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So it's kind of interesting because you don't always get them from out in the ocean or from a more natural source, right? Actually, some of your beluga whales originally came from places that maybe weren't so oriented toward, caring for these species, improving their care, understanding how to keep them, alive in both captivity and outside, right?
That's right. So from time to time, there are facilities, usually outside the more organized aquarium and zoo community, where animals find themselves in unfortunate situations. And we have a vehicle for helping those animals out. It's our 4R program, which stands for Rescue, Rehabilitation, Research, and Responsibility. And so we would take those animals and rescue them from whatever situation they were in. But the animals that you mentioned, beluga whales, there were some beluga whales in different parts of the world that aren't cared for to the same standard that we would hold. And so, we can consider that an act of rescue. And because we can put them into a group of people who, the care that the animals get when they're at the aquarium is just phenomenal, whether it's the husbandry staff who are, responsible for the day-to-day handling of the animals, the feeding of the animals, or whether it's the veterinary staff. We just have, through the Correll Center for Aquatic Animal Medicine, we have the most phenomenal veterinary hospital, and these animals get better care than most humans do. So the degree of care that they're getting in our facility is really excellent. We're really, really proud to be a part of that.
So how do you manage all that, right? You've got veterinary care, you've got diets, everything's got a different diet, and you're just learning what the optimum diet and the optimum biomarkers to figure out whether or not the diet's optimum in whale sharks and other species. How do you manage all that without going crazy?
Well, we're very lucky to have as part of that center a nutritionist. So we have someone on staff whose full-time job it is to be analyzing the diets that we're feeding the animals. Oftentimes, we aren't formulating these diets de novo. That is, we're not making it up. There's empirical experience from years of animal husbandry that we know that, you need to feed the species herring, squid, and capelin, for example. The question is, the nutritionist then comes in and analyzes that and says, okay, well, what's the nutritional value of what you're feeding? What's missing? What trace things do we need to make sure that these animals are getting, and what physiological indicators are the vets telling us suggest that the animal may be needing something or getting too much of something, because mm-hmm. too much is going to be just as bad as not enough. And so we're very lucky to have a nutritionist who can inform that process.
So basically what you're saying is just the feeding of the animals itself, right? Because the sort of the base diet, and then you're checking for various markers and things like that. Are they low in a particular salt, low in a particular amino acid, whatever it is? You need to think about supplementing those. Just feeding them is a giant science research project in and of itself.
It certainly is. And so record keeping becomes very important, because we have hundreds of species in the collection. We can't be studying to the nth degree in all of the species simultaneously, but we can certainly, we do it one species at a time. I mean, we move from a project, so you'll start with studying the diets of whale sharks or the diets of beluga whales, and you'll move into greater and greater detail tell with those species. We've done a lot of work with diets in our Asian small-clawed otters and our California sea otter populations, because it turns out that otters have some pretty unique nutritional needs. And so, you move through, if an animal tells you clinically that it needs some nutritional advice, then you put the nutritionist to work to try to understand that. And the nutritionist works with the husbandry managers and the vets, so that you take this sort of comprehensive team approach to tackling these problems. And the result is a happy, healthy otter or a happy, healthy whale.
Well, so basically that beluga whale you got in your basement, mm-hmm. Bill, yeah, I think mm-hmm. you're going to have to give that up under the four-hour program.
It was doing such a good job mowing the lawn.
So,
I had one question. So that you've got different tanks. Is the water in any way different, like where the spider crabs are? Is that a different mix than where the other ones are?
That's a great question. Actually, I'm really glad you asked me that, because one of my other hats at the aquarium is to work with the life support department, who are the engineers who keep the water in a state where it's optimal for life and also looking good for our guests, because there is an aesthetic component. You need the water mm-hmm. to be clear and looking great so that people can see the animals. And we have a unique challenge in Atlanta because we're 5 hours drive from the coast. So we can't pump seawater into the aquarium like a lot of aquariums do. We make our own seawater from Atlanta tap water with synthetic sea salts added to that. And then we have a tremendous amount of engineering and chemistry expertise that's brought to bear in keeping those systems exactly where they should be. So my team in the lab does about 4,000 water quality assays a week, which is a lot more than most aquariums, because we're a recirculating system and we need to monitor the water quality very, very closely. It is possible, most of the tanks are sort of connected together and you can move water from one exhibit to another. So there are unique challenges to do with how you treat the water as it moves around the system. And within any given exhibit, you have to tailor the water chemistry to suit the biology of the animal that lives there. So, for example, you mentioned the spider crab tank. That tank is going to be running at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's pretty cold. But our Ocean Voyager exhibit, where the whale sharks live, is 76.5. And over in our Tropical Diver Gallery, there may be some reef tanks that are warmer than that. So there, you do tailor both the temperature, the pH, the alkalinity. There's about 16 parameters that we monitor in most of our exhibits. And we have set ranges that we want to see on all of those. And we also set up triggered alarms so that if you get a number that's out of whack, you can take corrective action and return that water to the optimal condition for that animal.
So do you almost have some of the segregation of the animals based on temperature and pH and all that? Like the spider crabs wouldn't do well in the one with the beluga whale.
Right, so you can't necessarily share water. Yes, that's exactly right. And there are other requirements too. So when you talk about the marine mammal exhibits, those are regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so there are requirements for water quality under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so we manage those exhibits separately and differently than the way we would manage the fish systems. But it's all always tailored to the needs of the animal. And there's a tremendous amount of behind-the-scenes activity that goes on. It's a remarkable engineering feat. We have 10 million gallons of water in the building, and we filter hundreds of millions of gallons through the system in any given day, and that puts us on par with a large municipal water treatment facility. Wow. And so we've actually made friends with the people from Fulton County and Cobb County water treatment systems, and we find we have a lot in common with those folks because a lot of the engineering challenges are very similar.
So what you're actually saying is the water treatment folks and you can learn from each other.
Absolutely. Wow. They're trying to produce something that's good enough for you to drink. We're trying to produce something that's good enough for a fish to live in, and those challenges are pretty similar.
The only difference is they don't have any fish peeing in their water. That's basically
it. That's true. They don't, and they also don't have salt. So salt makes things all different at the aquarium, and so we have to be sensitive to their needs too. We can't be flushing large amounts of salt water down into the common sewer system. We don't want to do that anyway because salt is expensive, and we would rather keep the salt water inside mm-hmm. the exhibits and work hard to keep the chemistry where we want it to be.
All right, so on that note, we've reached the end of the program where we try to address what have we learned. And we've learned so much, I'm not even sure I can cover it all, but I'm going to take a crack at it. I think what we've learned is that via an integration of science and tourism at the George Aquarium and aquariums in general, aquariums no longer the circus sideshow that we think they are. We think they're just there so you can gawk at fish. But in fact, you have to have an integration of the scientific research just to keep the animals properly cared for. And then you learn from that, and then it's complemented by stuff that you learn in the field. So it really is a big science research project.
That's the idea. And in the same way that we contracted the words aquatic vivarium to make aquarium 100 years ago, we're now contracting the education and entertainment to make edutainment. And that's really the mission that we see for the aquarium, right, is to entertain and educate at the same time, right. And research is part of that.
But at the same time, you actually use this tourism attraction to raise funds to do research. And I know there are a lot of our colleagues here at Georgia Tech are thinking, well, that's, I'm not sure that seems like the right thing to do. But deep down, we're all thinking that's absolutely brilliant. And if you think about the fact that you sell silly bands, right, to, you know, fund one of your research projects, would you rather have the profit from silly bands simply go straight to a corporate entity, or would you rather have that go to support a research project to help you care for this collection, to educate people about it? And if you think about it, they are getting educated because they're learning the various nucleotides.
That's right. It's just a different funding model for science. And people should keep in mind that the aquarium is a nonprofit. It's a 501c3 nonprofit aquarium. So, you know, any money that we make from revenue streams like attendance gets plowed back into the education programs, the conservation programs, and the research program. And so people may come to the aquarium and say, wow, this place is really slick. You know, they must be doing all right. The truth is, that's in part a legacy of the gift that we got from the Marcus Foundation at the beginning that really got the aquarium started. Mm-hmm. And what happens to the revenue these days is that it gets plowed back into the other branches of the operation that meet our mission as an educational, scientific, and entertaining facility.
And what we really learned is that this is simply the continuing legacy of aquariums. That aquariums started this way. What was it? Felix Anton Dorn.
That's correct.
Who learned to fund his research in, you know, aquatic animals by actually charging people admission. So it's one of the few win-win situations I can think of in science, education, and, you know, tourism and entertainment.
We like to think so, yeah. It's a pleasure to be part of it. Having been on both sides of the fence as a more orthodox academic and someone who works in an aquarium system, they're very, very different worlds, but they both have the capacity to generate a tremendous amount of new knowledge about animals and to affect change that can conserve these species so that we can keep enjoying them in the future.
All right. So if you go down and do visit the aquarium, you need to realize that admission fee is in part supporting all this interesting research that is learning what is not known now, right? I mean, you learn slowly but surely about all these things. And this integrates with a number of different research projects here at Georgia Tech and down in Mexico and things like that.
That is correct.
Wow, that was absolutely fascinating. Did we leave anything out?
I don't think so. This is great. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show here on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.